Welcome to Talking History and the second show in our two-part series on the year 1968. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. Last week, we talked about the Civil Rights Movement in 1968. In a moment, we'll look at other events of that year when Talking History's Dennis Mihalik interviews historian James Farrell. But before that, let's look back at this week in history.
December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy. The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan.
Those, of course, were the words of President Franklin Roosevelt in his message to Congress asking for a declaration of war against the nation of Japan. The attack came at dawn on December 7th, 1941, on Pearl Harbor, and the results were not only a devastating blow to the American military and the loss of over 2,000 lives, but also American entrance into World War II. Turning to this week's history in the news, Americans claiming to be descendants of an ancient Indian tribe, thought extinct since the early 16th century, are causing historians and anthropologists to re-examine the history of the Taino Indians of the Caribbean. As the first people encountered by Columbus in 1492 and the first victims of European disease and slavery, the Taino tribe played a key role in shaping European thought about Native Americans. While most scholars label modern claims to Taino lineage unlikely, and even then impossible to prove, the quiet culture of an ancient people is demanding new attention from a world that had almost forgotten them. In other news, recently declassified documents from the State Department have revealed secret U.S. plans during the Johnson administration to bomb China and thereby thwart its efforts to develop nuclear weapons. Dry in their language and tone, the documents nonetheless reveal the dramatic implications of the hidden drama within President Johnson's cabinet in its plans to prevent the spread of nuclear weapons, and the enormous tension, fear, and pressure that weighed on American presidents throughout the Cold War to harness the destructive power of a weapon they had perfected. You are listening to Talking History. You say you want a revolution. Well, you almost got one in 1968, and the repercussions of that tumultuous year are still with us. Last week, we discussed the Civil Rights Movement in 1968. Now we turn to other developments with Talking History's Dennis Mihalik and his guest historian, James Farrell.
The confrontation was not created by the police. The confrontation was created by the people who charged the police. Gentlemen, get the thing straight once and for all. The policeman isn't there to create disorder. The policeman is there to preserve disorder.
That, of course, was Mayor Richard Daley of Chicago trying to explain the violence of the Democratic Convention of 1968. To put that event and others into perspective is our guest today, Dr. James J. Farrell, professor of history, director of American studies, and distinguished teaching professor of the humanities at St. Olaf College in Northfield, Minnesota. Professor Farrell is the author of The Spirit of the 60s, published by Routledge. Welcome, Dr. Farrell.
Hello.
When we think of the 1960s, why is it that 1968 seems to stand out? I mean, what happened in 68 to make it such a crucial and memorable year?
I think the main reason that 1968
stood out is Professor Farrell is the author of
Conflict and Turmoil, all of it in plain view. Some of it made for television, the rest of it perfectly suited for the conventions of TV, which require action, which is to say, moving pictures and drama. And so, for example, from the beginning of the year to the end, you have the Tet Offensive, the photograph of the Vietnamese official executing a prisoner, which was taken after that to be a metaphor for the cruelty of the war, the New Hampshire primary and the McCarthy phenomenon, the resignation of Lyndon Johnson, or the announcement that he wouldn't run again, the assassinations of Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy, race riots, especially in the wake of the King assassination, the student revolt at Columbia, the party conventions, including the Democratic National Convention, the Wallace candidacy, which was the first organized arena for the white backlash, the peace negotiations of September and October, the election itself the first inklings of women's liberation with the protest at the Miss America pageant. And then finally, and really uncharacteristic of the whole year, the gorgeous photograph of the Earth from space. But the most important thing, I think, was the election. It was the first election since the Johnson landslide of 1964, the first since the escalation of the war in 1965, the first since the big urban riots that began at Watts in 1965. And it would be the place where Americans decided on a direction in a time of turmoil. All of the events of the year were important, not just for themselves, but for how they would affect the elections.
Mm-hmm. Now, you say in drama. Let's say in the Columbia student activities, since so much of the 60s is seen in terms of a youth revolt. I mean, what actually was at stake in that student revolt at Columbia?
Well, Columbia's kind of an interesting case because it it comes late in the student movement, and it builds on a lot of things that had gone on before. And a lot of the things that the students were thinking about during the 1960s were issues that are still around to some extent today. One of them was bureaucracy, the kind of impersonalization of education. And so you got the slogan, do not fold, spindle, or mutilate, that was written on IBM cards. Another was university complicity in nuclear weapons and the Vietnam War. Another, more local, was just the whole idea of in loco parentis, that young people were being accused of, so still around to some extent today. And then the whole issue of relevance, whether or not education was relevant to the things that were going on. So, for example, in the 1960s, there were virtually no classes on Vietnam, few classes on African Americans or on women, few classes that went beyond the kind of functionalism or adjusting to the system. A lot of classes that were objective but didn't have much moral passion, what students came to call a split-level morality. And students kind of wanted to combine the academic and the activist.
Mm-hmm. So, for example, from the title of your book, The Spirit of the 60s, how would the student activities at Columbia reflect that spirit?
Well, they're really building on the sense that the most important thing is the inviolability of the person. In my book, I talk about what I call personalism, which is the understanding that you need to respect the individuality and the whole person, and they wanted education to do that. At Columbia, it's a little bit different because in 1968, the issues there are a little narrower than the broader student movement for the most part. The local issues at Columbia were, first of all, building a gymnasium on Morningside Heights, where the university boarded Harlem. And this raised a larger issue of the university as landlord and the university's relationship to the black community at a time when, in America's cities, there were race riots. And another issue that was...
So you mean, in order to build the gym, they would have had to, what, knock down housing of poor people, black people?
They had done that before, but actually on this site they wouldn't have had to do that. On this site there was, it was really on a hillside, and they wouldn't have had to do it, but it was right at the border there, and the question was whether or not the gymnasium would have any services for the people of Harlem. And the university kept adding more services that they would provide for the Harlem community, but it wasn't enough at that time for the students.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And the students were also very much opposed to the Institute for Defense Analysis, which was a Columbia institution that had implications of university complicity in the war machine. They thought that it was unconscionable for the university to be involved in that. And that went all the way back to the early free speech movement in 1964, where the students at Berkeley had pointed out that 54% of the university's income came from the federal government, and a lot of that through the nuclear weapons contracts.
Oh, so these were defense contracts then that the university professors were getting to do research for the government?
Yeah, they were research and development, and the Defense Department gave more contracts than any other department in the government.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and so what, the students are demanding that universities stop that kind of research?
Yeah, they were. They didn't think that was... that when research was contracted by the government like that, there wasn't a spirit of free inquiry involved, and so they wanted that to end. And this is also right in the middle of the Vietnam War, right in the middle of the time when students of that age are being asked to not being asked, being commanded through the draft to serve in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm. I see. Okay, and then obviously 1968 is also important in terms of that anti-war movement. I remember myself as a young man reading Norman Mailer's book published in 1968, Armies of the Night, where he describes his participation in a march on Washington. From your perspective, that is, writing on this this spirit, the motivation of individuals, how did that manifest itself in the anti-war movement?
Well, the spirit of the 60s that I look at is a spirit that's this personalism that I talk about. And it basically said that if people were created in God's image, other people were obligated to treat them well. So that, in some sense, the genesis of 60s protest was genesis. And the Vietnam War was an affront to personalist beliefs. The personalist focus on the life and dignity of individual human beings was contradicted by the slaughter of the war. And napalm and cluster bombs came to be condemned not just for efficiency, but for their impersonality. And by the late 1960s, especially after the bombing that began in 1965, personalists would decry the bombing morality of the war, whereby pilots flying at 50,000 feet could destroy people on the ground. And then you had every night on TV, the weekly, or not every night, but every week on TV, the body count, which was the ultimate degradation of personal dignity because the progress of the war was being measured by the destruction of persons. So in many ways, in the 1960s, you have what I would consider a religious revolt against the politics of the nation and the politics of the war.
Okay. That's what I was just going to ask. I mean, if you watch television and the portrayals of the youth of the 60s, it's always drugged out, self-centered individuals looking for instant gratification. And if I'm hearing you correctly, you're arguing that the spirit of the 60s was actually spiritual.
Yeah, I would argue that the spirit of the 60s is spiritual. I'd like to suggest that when we think of the 60s, we focus not on the Marxist radicalism of the late 60s, but on the religious radicalism that preceded it and pervaded the decade. Not on the newness of the new left, but on the oldness of its religious origins. Mm-hmm. Not on what Abby Hoffman called revolution for the hell of it, but on revolution for the heaven of it. And it seems to me that really the main character of the 1960s is Martin Luther King. He's an inspiration not just in the civil rights movement, but also in the anti-war movement. And it's a combination of his religious perspective with his perspective of American democratic values and his ability to merge those two voices that makes him such an important thing to really all of the protesters in the 1960s.
Mm-hmm. Well, in that sense, then, I mean, how would this relate to the counterculture? That is, most of the things I've read, the antecedent of the counterculture, are beatniks of the 50s. Was there a spiritual sense to the counterculture?
Yeah, I think there's a spiritual sense to the counterculture as well. And it has really to do, I think, as much as anything with the wholeness of human beings, the sense that the reason they would be counter to the culture the way it was that the culture the way it was constricted people within specific roles. And so the counterculture is looking for ways that people can be more human beings. And all the way back to the Beat Movement, you have a religious critique that comes out of somebody like Allen Ginsberg's Jewish religion, but then combines it, as Gary Snyder does, with a kind of Buddhist and Eastern religion. And those things are all connected with how do you make more human beings, how you develop a fuller understanding of what people are for. And in many ways, the counterculture is valuable for asking, I think, the really substantial questions like that. What are people for, and how do institutions serve them?
Mm-hmm. Now, I happen to read here recently that that hair is being revived, and it was a counterculture symbol and actually premiered on Broadway, I guess, or off-Broadway in 1968. Do you think a cultural presentation like hair captures the spirit of the 60s?
No, I'd say that hair actually captures the spirit that conquered the 60s. With the rise of the counterculture in the mid-1960s, you get a lot of people who see that the anti-materialism of the counterculture can make them some money, ironically. There's a wonderful book out now by Tom Frank called The Conquest of Cool, which talks about the ways in which businessmen simply take the signs of the counterculture and the signs of the new left and then sell them back to people with commodities so that you get, with cigarettes, you've come a long way, baby, where you get the Dodge Revolution, which was the way that cars were marketed in the late 1960s. And I think here is an example of what I would call the conquest of cool, or the appropriation or co-optation of cool.
Mm-hmm. Psychedelic t-shirts and all of these kinds of things. Co-optation, then?
Sure, the whole beads, mm-hmm. baubles, t-shirts, bell-bottoms, sandals. All of those things could make people money if they could associate them with the cool that was associated with the counterculture. But by the time you started buying those things, you weren't really very counter anymore.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, earlier you mentioned that women's liberation also emerged during this time, and just mentioned the co-optation in the You've Come a Long Way, Baby advertisement. An undying myth, of course, is the bra burning episode at which no bras were actually burned at the Miss America pageant in 1968. Is there a spiritual sense, or was there a spiritual sense to women's liberation?
I think in the same way that that the counterculture is asking about the full personhood of people, what feminism asks is for Americans to consider the personhood of womanhood. And that extends, if you want to think that the personal is political, which is one of the most important phrases of the 60s, and one that we associate more with the women's liberation movement, although it was a kind of standard phrase throughout the movements of the 1960s, it means that a lot of issues that hadn't been considered political before the 1960s would become political issues, so that abortion, rape, spousal abuse, child abuse, incest, sexual harassment, pornography, health care, lesbianism, even housework all become public policy issues during the 1970s and 80s. And the beginnings are really there in the 1960s as women are asking about, you know, what kind of whole people they can be given the constraints of American institutions and expectations.
Mm-hmm. Now, as you said, the outstanding feature of 1968 was its watchability on television, all of this drama. And it seems currently that trying to understand 1968 or even the 60s in some kind of balance is virtually impossible. That is, do you think that most commentators are guilty of either demonizing or romanticizing the year and the decade?
Yeah, I think that's probably the case. I think that the sort of standard understanding of the 60s, or what I would call the orthodox understanding of the 60s that's currently around, is that the 60s were the time period where America came to a crossroads and turned the wrong way. And that's been the kind of orthodoxy that's been espoused by people like Newt Gingrich, particularly, who want to work against the ideas that the kind of questioning also that comes up in the 1960s. And I think to some extent as a result of that and as a backlash to that, people who are sympathetic to the 60s have tended to romanticize them. And it's also amazing how younger people romanticize the 60s, so that when students take my classes, they have sort of an utterly romantic vision of what it was to be involved in the 60s and miss out on a lot of the complexities and trials and tribulations of being alive in that time.
Yes. Well, that's true, and unfortunately we can't handle all the complexities in 15 minutes, but I want to thank you for your very interesting observations, thanking our guest, Dr. James J. Farrell from St. Olaf College.
Something happened here, what it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
Welcome back to Talking History. Our historic site of the week, an unusual site at that, also relates to the year 1968, and here to tell us about it is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
The News Museum in Arlington, Virginia is just across the Potomac River from Washington, D.C. It gives visitors a chance to see behind the scenes of how and why news is made and to actually participate in making the news. It also showcases hundreds of objects associated with news events and people. Earlier this year, the museum had a special exhibit on 1968, which can be seen on the web at www.freedomforum.org/newsmuseumsnews, and then go to special exhibits. There you will find coverage of the events of 1968, from protesters to politicians. The museum is open year-round, Wednesday through Sunday, and admission is free.
Thank you, Cindy. Once there were only two nuclear powers locked in a titanic struggle to determine the fate of the world. That struggle between the United States and the Soviet Union has come to an end, but as recent developments in India and Pakistan remind us, nuclear arms have proliferated, posing a new threat to the world, or so many people think. Here to talk about the myths surrounding nuclear weapons in Cold War and post-Cold War history is Ira Chernus, professor of religious studies at the University of Colorado at Boulder. The title of Professor Chernus's op-ed is Time to Question the Nuclear Myth.
When India and Pakistan detonated their nuclear tests this year, politicians and pundits in the U.S. used the occasion to proclaim a myth of Cold War stability. Back in the days of superpower rivalry, they assured us, U.S. and Soviet leaders talked together as reasonable men and worked out reasonable arrangements to protect us from the bomb. Everything was safely under control. This myth may offer reassurance, but it does not reflect historical reality. In the early 1950s, when the myth was born, there was a widespread sense of instability. People were horrified. Back in the days of super-built and tested nuclear weapons, like two kids in a schoolyard, President Dwight Eisenhower wanted desperately to calm nuclear fears so that he could keep his allies and woo neutrals while building more nuclear weapons. So in 1955, he reluctantly agreed to the first summit meeting at Geneva. There he smiled warmly, shook hands with Soviet leaders, and proposed a plan for open skies so that each side could see the other's military preparations. Thus was born the so-called spirit of Geneva. But at Geneva and the summits that followed it, superpower leaders were not resolving their conflicts cooperatively. They were dueling with words, just as Indian and Pakistani leaders do today. The Soviets immediately rejected open skies because it would have given the U.S. a greater spying advantage, as Ike well knew. The spirit of Geneva soon became a fond memory, while reality remained unstable. The Soviets crushed the Hungarian Revolt of 1956 and launched Sputnik in 1957. U.S. leaders responded by demanding more nuclear weaponry. On both sides, talk of banning nuclear tests was more for propaganda than for saving humanity. When the Cuban Missile Crisis erupted in 1963, President Kennedy could only figure the rough odds on starting World War III and hope for the best. No mechanisms of control kept that situation stable. In the wake of the missile crisis, world outrage again forced the reluctant superpowers to the negotiating table, where they signed a limited test ban treaty, but once again the reassuring impression of stability would only be temporary. When the Cold War ended, the myth of superpower stability was widely accepted as authentic history. The Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty seems to give the myth credence. Here are the five members of the nuclear club apparently agreeing to cap the arms race. But the treaty merely bans old-fashioned nuclear tests, the kind India and Pakistan can afford. It allows the high-tech and computerized testing that only the U.S. can carry out. India and Pakistan have objected loudly to this double standard, but in this country their complaints are rarely heard. The U.S. military still deploys thousands of nuclear weapons. The Stockpile Stewardship Program funds planning for a whole new generation of nuclear weapons to be tested in the laboratory. The nuclear arms race goes on. The record of the nuclear age shows that bombs, whether past, present, or future, always generate anxiety and threats of war. The idea that our bombs breed stability while only their bombs breed war is a dangerous self-deception. India and Pakistan have been trying to tell us that for years. It's too bad that we did not get the point before they got the bomb.
You've been listening to Ira Chernus, professor of religious studies at the University of Colorado at Boulder. Professor Chernus's remarks come to us courtesy of the History News Service. And this is Talking History. And finally, turning to our list of coming attractions, if you're up for more on political protests, we call to your attention to the enactment of public health years ago that led to the Boston Tea Party. The reenactment will be held in Boston's Old South Meeting House on December 13th. For more information, call the Old South Meeting House at 617-482-6439. And if you prefer something less agitating, you can always catch the 7th Annual Holiday House Tour of historic Bedford, Massachusetts on December 6th. For information, contact the New Bedford Preservation Society at 508-997-6425. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed our show and that you will join us next week when we will be interviewing the only reporter to spend the entire time behind Indian lines during the occupation of the village of Wounded Knee, South Dakota, 25 years ago. In the meantime, we invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. And until next time, from the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau. Thank you.